from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you don't live in Turkey or Argentina or South Africa, if you aren't a stock trader or portfolio manager or active investor, you may have missed the recent shudders in the global economy. Bankers and traders all over are eyeing the world's emerging markets. Currencies are tumbling, central banks are scrambling, and a lot of fingers are on a lot of triggers. Because in this globalized world, we've all got some stake in each other's economic welfare. This hour On Point, the wave of fear over and in the world's emerging markets right now, and what it's all about. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you assuming there's a new crop of up-and-coming economies, countries, ready to drive the world forward? What if there's not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Stock market sliding all over the place in recent days and weeks. Here was a close on CNBC on Friday. End of a rough week sizing up global markets.
It is another painful day for currencies across emerging markets. The ones in the firing line as we speak, the Hungarian forint, the Russian ruble, also stronger emerging market economies like the Mexican peso and the Polish zloty. And investors are pouring money into safe haven currencies like the U.S. dollar and like the Japanese yen.
But does it all come home? You bet it does. Look at the U.S. stock markets in recent days. Joining me first from New York right now is Mike Regan, editor-at-large for Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom.
What is the link between these enormous slides we've seen on American markets and what's going on in emerging markets, Mike?
Well, it all reminds me of the old cliche that when the U.S. sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. And in this case, what we have is the Federal Reserve had been really pumping a lot of money into the financial markets for a few years there, buying $85 billion worth of bonds a month. And their goal really was to lower interest rates in the U.S. And if you lower the treasury rates, then a lot of the other, you know, the commercial lending rates, mortgage rates, follow those treasury rates lower. And it succeeded in that point in the respect that borrowing costs became very low. It sort of helped kickstart the U.S. economy and by virtue of the global economy. But what happened is with those interest rates so low, a lot of investors really went looking for higher yield elsewhere. So you saw a lot of money flowing into emerging markets. You know, these are all obviously countries that are very unique, have their own issues, their own economies, but, you know, they typically tend to provide higher yields than developed nation bonds and a lot of times stocks too. So,
and Mike, we're really talking here, this latest interest has been beyond, China is out there and Brazil, India, Russia, but people looking beyond that at this tier of Turkey and Argentina and South Africa, Indonesia, Thailand, and so on.
Right. Argentina has really been a flashpoint. And what happened there is the Argentino peso had really been propped up by the central bank government down there. They had been buying the peso, using their dollar foreign currency reserves to buy the peso in order to keep it strong as it weakened as this all, you know, the pundits are calling it a normalization of monetary policy, which is maybe a nice way of saying the sort of chaos that's going on right now.
But are you saying, Mike, that with the Fed, I mean, they've backed off on their bond buying from $85 billion a month down to $75, now down to $65 billion a month as of last week. That's still a lot. U.S. interest rates still aren't very high. So why is money flooding back out of these markets, emerging markets, and back to the U.S.?
Well, obviously, smart investors try to identify a trend and trade ahead of it. So, you know, it's clear the Fed is sort of telegraphing that it probably will continue to keep reducing bond purchases throughout the year. So that's really, you know, people are preparing for that. And as a result of that, that tends to make the dollar stronger. You know, if the Fed not pumping dollars into the financial system every month or pumping less dollars into the financial system every month, it really, you know, in theory, it should cause treasury rates to go up, which is, you know, going to attract more investors to trade their pesos or their lira for dollars in order to get in on the higher interest rates in the U.S. Now, because of all the turmoil, that hasn't quite happened. Treasury rates are still, you know, near their historic lows. So it's kind of a delicate thing for the Fed to pull off at the moment to unwind this stimulus without causing more chaos. And a lot of central bankers are really starting to take note. South Africa's finance minister today really, you know, backed up his central bank governor saying, you know, the Fed really needs needs to come out and address what's going on. A lot of people were disappointed last week when the Fed released its statement and said, yes, we're going to trim purchases again this month. But they really made no mention of emerging markets. And people were disappointed on that. They want to know that the Fed is watching this situation in emerging markets and that these currencies are really taking a big hit down there. And what's happening then is as the currencies get weaker, you see real big problems with inflation. We had a great story today from some reporters in Argentina, Raymond Collet and Camilo Russo, who they actually went out to a market in Argentina and they found a guy named Jorge Contreras. And he's a welder, a delivery man, you know, a working guy. And he was looking for shoes to buy for his daughter. And he ended up having to buy used shoes for $5. And, you know, they described him sort of trying to fix up the shoes, wiping the dirt off with his shirt sleeve. Now, a week ago, this guy, you know, was planning to buy new shoes for his daughter. Now he's forced to buy used shoes. And it really, you know, hammers home how bad that inflation problem is getting in Argentina. You know, the estimates for last year were that inflation ran up 28% in Argentina.
Wow. Mike, if all this money is flowing back to the U.S., and then giving these emerging markets trouble. Why is the U.S. stock market down? Why isn't it up if money's coming back here?
Well, it's really just concern about how far will this turmoil go. I mean, obviously, you know, like I said, when the U.S. sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. That doesn't mean we won't catch it right back from them. And, you know, if all these...
contagion scenario.
Exactly. So, you know, right now, like you said, we're looking at the Dow down more than about 7% for the year after a really strong year last year. So, you know, it's anyone's guess as far as, you know, how far this is going to go. There did seem some support in the market last week with the S&P right around the 1770 level. That seemed to be like the line in the sand where the bulls didn't want to take it below that. But, you know, as markets opened this week, we just blew past that level. You know, S&P down as low as, you know, in the 1740s yesterday. So, below what a lot of people thought was a support level. So it's sort of, you know, anyone's guess right now how far this will go. Citigroup analysts actually were out with a note today saying they don't expect it to get much more ugly out there. They say the real issue is China and how hard of a landing China's economy is going to have. And they don't expect it to be too bad to cause the song to go much further. But obviously, it's a very open question at the moment.
The Economist magazine headline, "Don't Panic Right Now." Mike Regan giving us good opening salvo of insight on what's going on. Mike, editor-at-large at Bloomberg News in New York. Thank you very much for joining us, Mike.
Thank you, Tom.
Here last Wednesday, Turkey's central bank jacked interest rates up, big effort to try and stabilize their tumbling currency, the lira. Controversial move, didn't satisfy markets. Here's the central bank leader, translated by Reuters.
2002 yılından bu yana enflasyonla mücadelede elde ettiğimiz kazanımları koruyarak,
since 2002, it has been our primary mission to further the success we achieved in our struggle against inflation. In this direction, nobody should hesitate that the central bank will use all its instruments effectively to control inflation and to attain a 5% inflation target.
Turkey and a whole lot of other emerging markets scrambling right now. People talking, worrying about contagion that could come back and hit the U.S. and much more. Right now, joining us from Washington, Scheherazade Rahman, professor of international business, finance, international affairs at George Washington University. Scheherazade, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
We thought that, I mean, nothing lasts forever, but for a long time now, these were countries people were looking to as the next big wave of growth and development in the world. This was supposed to be the growth phalanx. What's happening, Scheherazade?
Well, look, you know, the big shift has happened. You know, the share of emerging markets in terms of global GDP, gross domestic product, has increased dramatically in a very fast pace over the last 20 years. It was 40% in 97. It's about 55% in 2013. So the bottom line is emerging markets will continue to increase their share of contribution to the global economy. But the pace of that increase has slowed down. The BRICS, the big countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, all have slowed down. And off the five, I believe only China is the one that's going to have good performance. India, Russia, Brazil, and South Africa are lowering in their performance, and I believe that's where it's going to stay. So that's the first point. The second point is something that you mentioned and alluded to earlier. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a changing of the guard amongst the emerging markets in their share of growth and contribution to the world's GDP. The frontier markets, Nigeria, Cambodia, Vietnam, Qatar, Romania, Pakistan, these are the countries that will probably contribute more now to the share of emerging markets as we go forward.
Is that because they're legitimately set to bring on real strong growth, or just because people are desperate to find a new, you know, fill in the blank where emerging markets used to pay? Now let's look at Cambodia.
I think it's the latter. There is some real growth there for sure, but I think it's more the latter because we are seeing easing off in the other bigger markets. And there's one more item coming into 2014. We're seeing emerging markets much more vulnerable to shocks as we're turning this year and going forward. You know, and this is a surprise to most people because most of these emerging markets have accumulated large hard currency reserves, which usually fosters stability. Mm-hmm. But the problem is emerging markets are so successfully integrated into the global economy, it leaves them vulnerable to outside shocks. And we are seeing that. You just mentioned the U.S. Fed. You know, the U.S. Fed's first concern is the U.S. economy. Let's be honest about that. Sure, they have their eye on the emerging markets, but Janet Yellen's focus is this country first. And the fallout may be the emerging markets. The bottom line is I don't expect the emerging markets to cause long-term trouble for the U.S. You know, it's more of a regional situation, but it's scaring people right now.
Contagion? You don't see it coming. You don't see it spreading. You don't see it hitting the big economies.
I think it's temporal. I think the growth here is based on real growth. This is not growth stimulated by the emerging markets. This is the U.S. recovery. It's slow.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound of protests there and pushback in Kiev. In Ukraine, is not just money moving that's got things in an upset state lately. In emerging markets and beyond, there is trouble around in stock markets and in countries where people had hoped to see strong growth contributing to global growth right now. There is a big hiccup going on. Scheherazade Rahman joins us from Washington, George Washington University. You can join us this hour as well. We're looking at the global stock sell-off and a wave of fear over and in emerging markets. Once darlings, now many stumbling, looking at how some of it comes back to the U.S. and the Fed and looking at where it may go next. Plenty of moves by the Fed, plenty of finger-pointing abroad. Here was India's central bank governor. This is Raghuram Rajan on Bloomberg TV India last week, scolding the U.S. and other industrialized countries for running economic policies for their own benefit, he said, and not coordinating with the developing world. We need to coordinate, he said.
International monetary cooperation has broken down. Industrial countries have to play a part in restoring that. And they cannot at this point wash their hands off and say, we will do what we need to, you do the adjustment we need to.
You do the adjustment. And the cry coming up around the world, United States, where are you? There's too much chaos out here. There's too much instability. The U.S. not playing a big enough role in kind of putting a rudder under all of this. Secretary of State John Kerry felt obliged to respond to that. So did Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel last week at Davos, the World Economic Forum. Here was John Kerry.
I am perplexed by claims that I occasionally hear that somehow America is disengaging from the world. This myth that we are pulling back or giving up or standing down. In fact, I want to make it clear today that nothing could be further from the truth. This misperception, and in some case, driven narrative, appears to be based on the simplistic assumption that our only tool of influence is our military.
John Kerry in Davos. We're not disengaging. Stop talking like that. Well, the world is wondering. Scheherazade Rahman, stand by in Washington with us right now as well. From New York is Ian Bremmer, president and founder of Eurasia Group, research and consulting firm focused on global political risk, author of Every Nation for Itself. Ian Bremmer, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be with you.
What is going on here? Is this the Fed undermining all these countries? Do we have a wave of instability in emerging markets, countries around the world that's somehow all coming to a head at the same time? What's happening?
It's not everywhere, certainly. I mean, there are countries we haven't talked about that are doing very well. Mexico is an emerging market country that not only benefits from the U.S. getting out of recession, but also has a president that's reached out, created a strong pattern of political and economic reform, including energy reform, that's going to put them on track to become the world's next developed country. And there are other countries we can look at, Colombia, that's doing quite well in this environment, some of the Southeast Asians. Sherazad mentioned some of the frontier markets that aren't just smoke and mirrors. Some are actually performing quite well in sub-Saharan Africa and will continue to. But there's no question there are some real problems here. A couple points to mention. You've already heard about the concerns about the U.S. taper, so the U.S. isn't putting easy money out there for everyone
the
to
taper,
extend
that's the
credit.
The Fed leaning off of its big bond buying program.
That's one big point. It's real. But a second one is that you have 44 elections in the emerging market world this year. That's a hell of a lot. It's more than we've seen in any year since 2007. In other words, since the financial crisis. Not the best time for that because, of course, we know what when elections happen, you're not focusing on big policy making. You're focusing on, sort of just throwing the people what they want short term. And the investors in the markets don't like that. You also have a reality that middle classes, as these emerging markets become wealthier, these middle classes demand more, and they're willing to go out in the streets. They're willing to create instability to get the kind of accountability from their leaders they want, and we're seeing that in spades in Turkey, in Thailand, in Ukraine, in Brazil. And that level of instability in many of the world's emerging markets is spooking investors, no matter what central bank governors may be willing to do to make these countries more attractive short-term economically. The political leaders and the facts on the ground make these countries less attractive politically. And if you're going to put your money there in an emerging market, it's not just the economics that are going to drive your outcomes. It's the politics, too.
Here's the sound of a little of that upheaval outside a polling station in Bangkok, Thailand, over the weekend. Shahrzad Rahman, what do you make of that? 44 elections, that's enough to get the pot boiling in lots of countries. Are we moving for some reason into a period of less stability, less steadiness in these developing countries? Is there some kind of contagion, not an economic contagion or a market contagion, but something else going on here? Or is it just happenstance that we've got some chaos, some turmoil, lots of elections all at the same time, Shahrzad?
Well, I think it's a combination of events. And Ian just mentioned 44 elections, which is unprecedented in these countries. And you'll hear a lot of rhetoric, either this from India or from South Africa or Turkey. But clearly, there is a lull in terms of economic growth in these countries, barring none. And, Ian mentioned the middle class and demands being put on governments. And he's absolutely right. The problem, there's a disconnect here. Economic growth at 10% is fine. It generates enormous amounts of wealth. The problem is the wealth is not evenly distributed, which is normal in emerging markets, has to be dealt with at some point down the road. But the more critical aspect of this is that systemic progress cannot keep up with 10% growth rates. To establish functioning, effective labor and capital markets takes a very long time, at least if you're going to go up to middle-class standards. And there is a disconnect here. And I think that's coming to play, that these countries have to take a step back and then deal with these issues of labor markets and capital markets that need to deliver more to the middle class.
Ian Bremmer, lots of people looking at the U.S. Fed, but also a lot of people looking at China. Growth is still strong there, but it's not that white-hot, double-digit growth China had for so long. And, of course, that's a market for a lot of products from these countries and a lot of commodities from these countries. What about the impact of China's slowdown?
Well, China growing at 7.5% from the size of today's economy, which is the world's second largest and larger than that of all the other BRICS, including South Africa combined, matters a lot more to the global economy than when they grew at 11% and the economy was half as big. So, on the one hand, I think we're overplaying, oh my God, China's going down to 7.5%, 7%, it's a disaster. I think the issue is not the numbers that we're seeing today from China. It's the fact that we have a leader, Xi Jinping, mm-hmm. who is truly engaged in reforming and restructuring this economy. That includes explicitly dealing with shadow lending practices and bad loans. It means tightening up credit for state-owned enterprises that have used that money very inefficiently. And it probably means pulling back on infrastructure. And that creates uncertainty, right? We've seen more reform in the last 6 months in China than we've seen for the last 20 years. And this is a huge economy with 1.3 billion people. We don't know if it's going to work. We certainly don't know if it's going to work well. It's going to disenfranchise and a lot of very powerful Chinese people. They might not like that. So I think that...
Why does that matter to the rest of the world, Ian, the emerging market world in particular?
It matters immensely to the rest of the world because of the size of China. I mean, you know, you heard from your Bloomberg guest mm-hmm. at the beginning, if the U.S. sneezes, the rest of the world gets a cold. Well, increasingly that's true of China because of the size of the Chinese market.
So reform means slower growth. Slower growth means trouble elsewhere.
Reform means slower growth, but botched reform means huge uncertainty. Reform means we're not sure if it's just a question of, I mean, the Chinese government has said their expectations for this year are consistent over 7% growth. And what they say sotto voce is they're not going to move much beyond that, much below that next year. If that's true, the markets will be okay with those numbers. It's that there's much greater uncertainty. You know, when the United States talked about the taper from quantitative easing last year, you had a huge hit on emerging markets then, well before the taper came, because number one, people didn't know who the next Fed chair was going to be. Mm. Number two, they didn't know how big and how gradual the taper would be when it hit. And number three, they weren't yet convinced of the strength, the robustness of the American pickup from recession, the bounce. Well, in China, I think that's precisely what you're seeing right now. It's not the numbers of 7%+ this year growth, that would be okay. It's the much greater level of uncertainty that accompanies a Chinese leadership that is starting to actually engage in structural reform. It's dangerous. It's uncertain.
Ian Bremmer, Shahrzad Rahman, please stand by. I want to go to our listeners, New Orleans. Michael is calling. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Michael. What's on your mind?
My question is, it appeared that quantitative easing was to inject money into the U.S. economy so that it would stimulate our economy, but it appears that a vast amount of this money went to foreign countries or these emerging markets while they were chasing higher returns. Did that cause, well, first, did quantitative easing not have the effect that the Fed hoped it would have? And then is this an unexpected consequence? And did the Fed know about it while quantitative easing was going on?
Interesting. Shahrzad, how about it? Quantitative easing put a lot of money in the system. Did that blow up a balloon that's now popping in the emerging markets?
Well, in some ways, you know, clearly quantitative easing drastically increased the amount of cheap money that was flooding developing countries. I mean, it flooded our markets as well. You know, mm-hmm. it did the trick. You know, the markets recovered. The economy is back on track, slow, but back on track. And hopefully the Fed can pull off the easing, you know, in terms of reducing this vast asset purchase program without, you know, blowing up other economies. But there will be a shock in the system. We are watching it happen. You know, whether this actually tapers off 6 months from now is a big question.
The inflation we see these emerging markets dealing with, does that presage inflation here, or are they different dynamics, Shahrzad?
There are different dynamics, you know, but you are watching interest rates go up in all these countries, partly to combat inflation, but also partly to entice the inflow of dollars back into these economies, you know, because money is moving out of these countries right now.
Ian, we heard Raghuram Rajan, the Indian central bank chief there, not very happy with the U.S. and other big economies on the way this is being unwound. I mean, it's tough enough to unwind at home. What about our caller's question about what the Fed could anticipate in its readiness to deal with the global consequences of unwinding?
Look, I mean, Raghuram is an impressive, you know, sort of policymaker, technocrat, educated from UChicago. The West likes him and India likes him. But he's dealing with an economy that is vastly underperforming in India. And the reason it's vastly underperforming, and in fact, the reason, I mean, Indian growth has been, I would say, you know, 300, 400 basis points lower than it probably should be, is because of the Indian government, not because of U.S. quantitative easing or not. He knows that. The Indians are facing a very difficult electoral cycle. The very fact that he says, well, we did our part and now the U.S. doesn't care about emerging markets. Well, what exactly is it that the developing markets did to support the United States or Europe or Japan that wasn't in their interests after the financial crisis? That's just spoken. It's not true. It just didn't happen. The problem we have, and Raghuram is right in this, is that there's no international architecture. There's no cooperation or leadership at the global level, either from China, the U.S., or anyone else. The willingness to participate in promoting global norms and values and institutions is vastly lower today than it was coming out of World War II or in the depths of the Cold War. And if you're in an emerging market getting buffeted by that, that's frustrating to you. It concerns you a great deal.
We heard John Kerry saying, we're not disengaging, we're not disengaging. And yet there is this feeling abroad globally that things just aren't knit together as they once were. Is that a problem? Is that healthy, Ian? Because, you know, in a way, that was hegemonistic. Or is this bad, good, or dangerous, inevitable?
Well, I think it's extraordinary to me that Kerry has said this. I saw him say that in Davos. I saw him say it in Munich this past weekend as well, when he said the U.S. is not in retreat. I can't think of a place in the world the U.S. is in retreat. What do you call Afghanistan? What do you call Iraq? It's not disengaging. What do you call the red line in Syria and now the
that
you know,
wasn't followed up on, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know what you call. I mean, maybe retreat is not the word he wants to use. Not disengage. Maybe he has a different word. But tell me what
he
it
was
is.
Saying.
Tell
the American people. Do we have to be at war everywhere to be engaged? Surely those don't have to be synonymous.
No. Of course not.
Well, that's Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria.
Not Syria. I mean, Syria
would have been.
If you think that the only way to engage in Syria is to actually drop bombs on them, I wouldn't say that myself. I think that the willingness of the United States, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, mm-hmm. was supposed to be done by the end of 2013. That's not war.
Yep,
40% of the world's GDP. Obama doesn't go to the APEC summit. It doesn't get done by the end of 2013. You've got a huge fight in Congress to get trade promotion authority done. It's not getting done in 2014 before elections. And so maybe now you get this trade deal done in 2015. Every American ally that has signed up for that deal, who was promised by Obama and Biden and Mike Froman that it would be done by the end of last year, are now saying to the Americans, what the hell?
He couldn't go to the APEC summit because the U.S. budget, the debate was going over a cliff. Government was shut down. I mean,
exactly.
is there a political unraveling here that's now having a consequence globally?
Well, the interesting thing, right, is that the United States economy is not in decline. As you see, the mm-hmm. dollar's doing well. Markets have done well. Growth this year looks set to surprise on the upside. Every CEO you talk to, not just American, Chinese CEOs who are investing and trying to invest more in the U.S., they believe in the U.S. market. But they don't believe in U.S. foreign policy commitments. And that's true of every ally you can think of. You don't need to go to Japan. You can go to Canada. And they can say, what's the deal with the U.S.? Where is the U.S. internationally? So this false narrative that Kerry talks about of, you know, the U.S. is not disengaging, he needs to spend more time with American allies. They all believe it. The question is whether or not U.S. – it's clear that U.S. disengagement is bad for American allies. It's not clear U.S. disengagement is bad for the American people. You know, think about the Middle East. The U.S. produces 56% more oil today than it did 5 years ago. I feel pretty confident that the U.S. is the average U.S. Member of a U.S. citizen is at least 56% less interested in the Middle East today than they were 5 years ago.
But our markets are down too, not just theirs.
No, that's true. They are. But our markets were up, as you saw, like 27% last year. If you talk to the folks that are investing the money, the big CEOs, you ask them where they're planning on not only investing, but also starting to employ, looking for more jobs, overwhelmingly they're positive about the U.S.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the global stock sell-off and a wave of fear over and in emerging markets. Of course, it's right here as well. Here's anchor Scott Pelley on CBS getting filled in last night on this week's plunge in the American stock market.
The Nasdaq closed below 4,000 today for the first time since November, Scott. But the S&P 500, the index tied most closely to investors' retirement plans, had its biggest one-day drop since June.
CBS reporter Alexis Christophorus there, filling in CBS listeners. Of course, everybody who's into that is watching. Ian Bremmer's with us, president, founder of Eurasia Group, joins us from New York. Scheherazade Rahman joins us from Washington and George Washington University. Lots of response online. Steve writes to us, I'm up 16% in the last year, but still depressed. I'm still in. We're all insane. There's this feeling that things are kind of toppy. Ray says, could it be some combination, Scheherazade, of the end of a sort of irrational exuberance that can come during good times when something is the next it thing, and maybe the upper limits of rapid expansion of developing economies that are reaching some level of maturity? Are we out of that age, Scheherazade, where we can count on rank after rank of developing countries to kind of step up and boom, and with that, help drive the global economy?
Yeah, I think that there's clearly a lull here, and I think it's going to continue. The bottom line is emerging markets have to change their game now. Most emerging markets sustain their growth by using Western markets, by exporting to them, rather than local demand. That strategy has long passed its sell-by date now. They need to evolve. They need to become hubs of innovation and service sectors.
Can't just
and
export flip-flops to America.
That's exactly right. Those days are over, at least for the big BRICS. And hence you see the growth in those frontier markets, which are picking up the flip-flop business. So I think there has to be a reset button here. And that reset button will take reforms. Ian mentioned, China and unprecedented reforms. Well, the bottom line is the Chinese government had absolutely no choice. The number one public enemy in China right now is the sheer size of the number of people involved in the income inequality equation. There are 800 million people living on $10 or less a day. 85% of China's poor live in rural areas. 65% are concentrated in the country's west. They've got to get a handle on this, or you're looking at severe social unrest down the line.
What about inequality in the United States, Ian? Does that somehow play into this? I mean, if we are now accustomed to Walmart prices as being required for a lot of low-income Americans to get by, does that bring down the headroom for new economies to grow and prosper through exporting to the U.S.?
It will eventually. It doesn't now. The United States is still a very wealthy country. The level of inequality is, of course, very, very high here. But the instability it causes in the U.S. is insufficiently large to make policymakers in Washington do anything about it. I'd be much more concerned nearer term about inequality in Europe, even though the levels aren't as high as the United States on a state-by-state basis. They are in Europe as a whole, if you look at the European market as a whole. And the levels of unemployment in Europe, of course, are vastly higher. Youth unemployment vastly higher. And that's starting to cause radicalization in a grassroots way. It's starting to cause new political movements to pop up that aren't just going to stop new governance from happening, but have the potential to really destabilize some of these countries. So looking over the medium term, while this is an issue we'll continue to address ineffectively in the U.S., in Europe, it's absolutely a much more urgent priority.
It all ties together. Michael in Boston, thanks for calling, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is regarding Argentina.
Great.
The greedy investors who followed the allure of 17% return on phony bonds got into the fool's gold of a Ponzi scheme in Argentina. Argentina is a country that was number three, third richest in the world in 1900 and is among the poorest now. And since September of 1945 has been infected perilously by the Peronist infection of confiscatory tax policies within the country on wheat, beef, and soybeans, where they're taking up to 20% on an exportation tax, internal exportation tax.
But a lot of people poured money in there when they had that great return, when returns were almost nothing here. Point taken on that. What about it, Ian? Do you see, were investors in developing countries dreaming to pour money into, let's say, Argentina, just driven by desperation to find a return somewhere? Was it real?
They were. A lot of people invested with a lack of understanding in how politics works in Argentina. That's not true today. I mean, the people that are there now are value investors that are, you know, just they understand that the likelihood that they see any money back is low, and they think they're prepared to write it off. These are small bets that people are making in Argentina today. But, you know, your caller is absolutely right that in the 19th century, if you were in a European salon and you looked over at the Western Hemisphere, it was a close call as to whether you thought U.S. or Argentina was going to be the eventual country to really bet on in the region. And the Argentines did not reinvest. They had very cheap land. They took advantage of it, and they didn't actually build an economy that was sustainable. The problem, you go to Argentina today, and the quality of life is very nice. It's a beautiful place. People are very comfortable, but they still think of themselves as European, and they're fairly satisfied. Surprisingly satisfied with a very ineffective government. And so as a consequence, there's not a lot of clamoring for change in Argentina, despite the fact that this government is running out of money very precipitously, that you would see in many other emerging markets. Many in Argentina still think they're a developed economy.
Sherazad, here's a question from Meg on Facebook. She says, would love to hear about the balance of infrastructure investment versus domestic consumer spending versus export in these economies. She says, what's the structural weakness that's causing these markets to take a hit? Is it overinvestment in high return sectors like real estate and road building, plus high levels of debt financing? China, for example. How about it, Sherazad?
Yeah, I think that each of these large emerging markets has a different story. You can't sort of just say it's only one thing. You know, you take Brazil, for example. You know, clearly there, it's really the issue of the balance between the savings and investment in this country. The country just doesn't have enough domestic savings to keep up with the investment need this country
needs. Is that an inequality problem in Brazil?
Oh, absolutely. It plays itself out. This is a huge issue when it comes to income disparity. This translates into crime, health issues. Bottom line is Brazil's on a short leash here. They've got a very short lifeline. This year you've got the World Cup. 2016 you've got the Olympics. What then? And that's a real question mark. And I don't see anything dramatically improving in Brazil after the Olympics. Exports are going to be down because China, A, has slowed down, and B, they have a huge mine in Mongolia that they're going to tap, and they're not going to go after Brazilian exports.
Ian, you know, you can't help wondering if there's, you talked about the structural reforms going on in China right now. They're trying to address those. But you look around globally, inequality and how some of these things are rooted in. I was talking with somebody over the weekend who does business in Sao Paulo, where he said the inequality is so great that you've got lots of helicopters flying the rich around. And on the ground, you've got Brazilians in 5-, 6-, 7-hour traffic jams. So no wonder the economy can't do well. That things have just worked themselves into such a, almost a paralytic inequality there at this point. Do you see that repeated elsewhere?
If you look at the Brazilian, if you look at the Brazilian polls and ask the average citizen what they want today, what their expectations are, what's critical, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it was we want jobs, we want more money. That's not what they're saying today. They're actually saying we want infrastructure improvements, we want better education, we want better security, and that's harder for the government to fulfill. And the good news in Brazil is that these demands are not bring down Dilma Rousseff, who is actually set to win pretty comfortably her presidential reelection campaign later this year. It's more the concerns with the political system as a whole, very unlike what you're seeing demonstrations, for example, in Turkey right now, or Ukraine, or in Thailand, which are really about bringing down the government.
But I wonder if it's not the political system in the sense that infrastructure investment doesn't get made because the people in the helicopters don't need those roads. They're flying.
Oh, there's no question. And anyone that goes to Sao Paulo, I mean, you know, I travel there every once in a while, and you can sit for 3 hours from the airport just to get downtown. It's hard to be productive. I mean, if you're working class or aspiring middle class, and, you know, your kids are trying to get to school, you're trying to get to your job, and you're sitting on a bus, and it's pretty hellish. But having said that, inequality in Brazil is actually quite a bit lower than it is in many other emerging markets around the world. And I think that Dilma Rousseff and her supporters in the PT party in Brazil do understand that they're going to have to make some different fiscal choices, fundamentally different fiscal choices, to respond to these needs that aren't just going to be about getting the World Cup successful and getting the Olympics successful. Of all of the abilities of emerging market governments to respond to changing demands of their constituents, I'd be more optimistic about Brazil than I would be other places.
Shahrazad, we haven't even looked at environmental issues yet, and we should touch on that. But what about in the U.S., there's a sense that maybe we've kind of played out a political era and everybody's looking for a reset, not sure what that will look like. Is it possible that globally there's a sort of model of politics, distribution of wealth and income that is reaching a kind of chapter change here, Shahrazad?
Yeah, and I think you've touched upon something that's a pretty, pretty sensitive nerve. The World Economic Forum has listed its top 10 global risks for 2014 as severe income disparity. And, you know, this is not going away. It's just an elephant that's just getting bigger and bigger in the room. And, you know, it begs the question, do Western-style, you know, free market systems by default generate income disparity? You know, we don't have a solution for this. I don't think any country does, other than having a centrally planned system that redistributes wealth. And we most certainly don't want that in the West. And the question is, you know, what do we do now? I don't think anybody has an answer.
Talk about a big question mark. And that's just on the political / distribution side. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, thanks for calling. You're on.
Great. Thank you. Well, yes, environmental issues. I was just listening and just kind of stunned that you're talking about economic growth as if it's in a vacuum from any environmental effect. I mean, thanks for talking about the social effects, but
we've all seen the pictures out of China where the smog and pollution is so thick you can't see the building next door. Sarah.
Am I still talking?
Yes, you're on.
yes, of course. And I mean, any economic growth will entail burning of more and more and more fossil fuel, which will impact everyone and endanger our very possible existence on the planet. And I just don't see how you cannot be talking about that when you're talking about economic growth.
Well, let's go to it right now. Ian Bremmer, what about it? I mean, the images out of China are just shocking sometimes. And of course, that's just one country. We've got environmental questions and issues all over the place. Is there a potential, you know, are we reaching some kind of, I don't know, phase change there as well? It must go on. It can't go on.
Not yet. Not yet. That's the problem. Certainly if you live in Shanghai, the average income is $20,000 a year. Those folks are going to demand cleaner air. They'll get it. But 500 million Chinese live in the north and west of that country where they get highly subsidized coal. And it's cold in the winter, and they won't be able to work effectively if they don't get it. They know that. And if you were to ask those Chinese who, on balance, live 5 years less because of the impact that coal has in their atmosphere than other Chinese do, you will improve your life expectancy, but we're going to take away the coal. What do you think about that? They want the coal. They want the coal so their kids will have better opportunities. That's a real problem. Go to Europe today and you'll see that despite the fact the Europeans, who we've thought of as much greener than the United States, the Germans are burning much more coal now than the United States is. And the Europeans just gave up on country targets for renewable energy for 2030. Why? Because the U.S. energy revolution is so driving improved efficiency and productivity in the U.S. that the Europeans are worried that their economies won't grow enough to create jobs. So, yeah, I'm enormously concerned about the environment, but I'm rich. It's easy for me to be concerned about the environment. If I didn't have a job, it'd be much harder for me to be concerned about the environment. And the problem you have in the emerging market world in places like China and India, and also in Europe, which is struggling mightily to get out of the recession with vastly higher unemployment in the U.S., is their governments feel as if they do not have the luxury of caring about our world's environment. And frankly, if I were in their shoes, I'd be pretty empathetic to that perspective. That causes a huge problem to respond to your questioner, which is, again, a very right-minded question, but we have to answer it honestly.
Of course, Europe, it seems like 5 minutes ago, they were out front on the environment. Shahrazad, what about it? Environmental issues bringing a systemic challenge to the global economy now? Do you see that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just take a step back. Greater incidences of extreme weather events, floods, storms, greater incidences of natural catastrophes, earthquakes, tsunamis, greater incidences of man-made environmental catastrophes, nuclear accidents, oil spills. This is not going away. But Ian's right. We haven't reached a point of, you know, a critical mass where there is a serious movement to deal with this right now. Things are going to get a lot worse, unfortunately, before they get better here.
So step back and look at the stock market tumbles we've seen then so far this year, Shahrazad. What do you see? Do you see just a correction? They were zooming up last year, and now here's a pause? Or, I mean, does the music go on? You know, the band will start up again and on we go.
You mean in the United States?
Well, the U.S., but I guess globally as well, because surely over time one doesn't happen without the other.
Sure. I think I would separate the okay. two regions. I think in the U.S., we have a little bit of a blip because of China's slowing growth, because of emerging markets slowing down. But I think that the U.S. market is in recovery. I think the stock market will continue to rise. In the emerging markets, that's a different call. I think every country is going to be slightly different. But I think you will see a slowdown in the pace of change and growth.
Ian, how's that work out? Can we have that dappled picture there in the emerging market and still strong growth, healthy growth globally?
Well, it's hard to say. Again, it's a very varied market, and some emerging markets are going to do well in this environment, but some are going to fall apart. And we haven't even talked about energy yet. Prices are probably going down there, and that's great for inputs for emerging markets. But those petrostates like Russia and Venezuela and the Middle East, there's a reason the Middle East is getting more violent. There's a reason the U.S. isn't paying attention. That's going to get worse, too. So hard to put a single brush on this, Tom.
Time of change globally, and good heads up on many fronts today. Ian Bremmer, president and founder of Eurasia Group, joining us today from New York. Ian, it's always great to have you. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Shahrazad Rahman, professor of international business, finance, and international affairs at George Washington University. Shahrazad, you're great as well. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, in this hour tomorrow, we're going to talk with a panel of American community college presidents. They are grappling with a little bit of unraveling in this country. Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.